This is a family book. God showing himself through the Old Testament. Chapter 1, beginning in verse 1. It's also scene 1. Hold your finger in the place because we'll be driving right straight through the book as we go. There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job. And that man was perfect and upright, one that feared God and eschewed evil. And there were born unto him 7 sons and 3 daughters. His substance also was 7,000 sheep. Those of you who can remember figures, remember these figures carefully, because we'll want them before we're through with the book. His substance also was 7,000 sheep and 3,000 camels and 500 yoke of oxen and 500 she asses and a very great household, so that this man was the greatest of all the men of the east. And his sons went and feasted in their houses every one his day, and sent and called for their 3 sisters to eat and to drink with them. And it was so, when the days of their feasting were gone about, that Job sent and sanctified them, rose up early in the morning, and offered burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, "It may be that my sons have sinned, and cursed God in their hearts." Thus did Job continually. Now that's the end of scene 1. We don't know where Uz was, insofar as that first verse is concerned, but we know that this man Job lived. This is not a play. This is not fiction. I'm referring to these things as scenes as we go along. But when I do so, I'm not indicating for an instant that this is a fictitious character. Job lived, and he could feel pain and happiness and joy in the same way that you feel it. God said that there was a man. So this is not fiction. This man, God went on to say in verse 1, and this is the introduction, this is the feature character here. God's describing him. He said he's a perfect and an upright man. And when he used the word perfect, the Hebrew word is tamim. That is, he's an all-round good man. He's the kind of a man who went round and opened the car door for his wife, whether there was anyone there to see him or not, if you get what I mean. He was always the same. And it wasn't just to make an impression that he was good. He was always that way. And he was a man that feared God and eschewed evil. I don't know what God has to say about me today. And don't forget, Job doesn't know this about God either, that God's saying this about him. We do. Job didn't. God said, now there's a good man. And he eschews evil. He's upright. He's good. This was God's opinion of Job. This is his character then. Not a reputation, his character. And there were born unto him 7 sons and 3 daughters. He's a family man. There's love there. 7 sons, 3 daughters. Remember those figures too. And his substance also was 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500. These were the stocks and bonds of that day. And it says that this man had a very great household, the greatest of all the men of the East. Now the East has produced some multimillionaires. And this man in his day would have corresponded to the greatest. He was king, 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 king. No one greater, multi-millionaire in his day. Wealth of all kinds, stocks and bonds, these were the ones. These were the way they figured them in those days. And beyond this, he's something more than just a family man. There's something unusual about his family. His sons went and feasted in their houses every one his day. That is, one day they go to John's house, the next day to Bob's house, the next day to Tom's house. I don't mean one day after another. I mean they'd have family reunions frequently, and they'd take turns having them in their homes. This is a common practice. This is what Job's sons were doing. But the unusual thing was they sent and called for their 3 sisters to eat and to drink with them. Now, that's the unusual point. I think it was Plato who said there were 3 levels of life in his day. There was man up at the top of the pyramid of life. And then there was the dumb brute down at the bottom. And guess what came halfway between? Woman. Certainly not on a level with man, not on a level with the dumb brute either. But what a tremendous difference between that and the Christian concept. Or this concept. In other words, the whole society was built on the idea that men were at the top and women were down here as some kind of almost slave, burden bearer. Not quite on a level with an animal, but certainly not on a level with man. But Job's sons had shot through those social barriers. And when they had a family reunion, they invited their sisters to eat and to drink with them. We say that our children are involved in the society around them. And it's hard to penetrate the social customs of our day. And we tremble when we see what goes on in the teenage world. But it's possible. Job did it in his day. Somehow or other, this man had been able to get through to his sons and daughters on this subject. That's not the only time we'll see again before it's over. But Job is more than just the oldest male member of his household, and there's another indication of that in verse 5, the very thing that we've been doing. It was so when the days of their feasting were gone about, Job sent and sanctified them. That is, he desired to see them become holy. And he rose up early in the morning and offered burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, it may be that my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts. Thus did Job continue. He didn't mean that he was afraid that his sons would just stand there and swear at God, curse God in their hearts. But the Hebrew word means to say good farewell to God. That's the literal meaning, to say farewell to God. To say, well, goodbye God. That is, they become so wrapped up in their business that they just wouldn't have time for God. I'm so involved with this. And I'm just getting started in life, and I'll just, well, goodbye God. I just don't have time. Job's concerned lest his sons get this way, and so he prays for them. He offers sacrifice for them. Thus did Job continually. There's some men in the household, you know, the only way you can tell that they're the head of the household is that they're the oldest male member. But Job is a spiritual father in his household. He has the spiritual concern of his children at heart. Now, this is the man that we're talking about. And don't forget that God said he's a good man. This is God's opinion of him. Wealthy, good. A family man. A man who prays for his family. Scene 2 begins in verse 6. Now, there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord. Satan came also among them. Scene 1 took place on earth. You tell me where scene 2 is taking place. Heaven? How'd Satan get there? I had enough trouble with him down here. I don't want him up there. Second thought, maybe that's a good place for him, isn't it? At least he can be under control up there, son. Well, we'll see. The sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord. You're so right. This is heaven. And Satan came also among them. Satan's there. And the Lord said unto Satan, whence comest thou? Then Satan answered the Lord and said, from going to and fro in the earth and from walking up and down and shooting to and fro in the earth. Insolent response. And the Lord said unto Satan, Satan, hast thou considered my servant Job, that there is none like him in the earth, a perfect and an upright man, one that feareth God and escheweth evil? Then Satan answered the Lord and said, doth Job fear God for naught? Hast not thou made an hedge about him and about his house and about all that he hath on every side? Thou hast blessed the work of his hands. His substance is increased in the land. But put forth thine hand now and touch all that he hath, and he will curse thee to thy face. And the Lord said unto Satan, behold, all that he hath is in thy power. Only upon himself put not forth thy hand. So Satan went forth from the presence of the Lord. Now, that's a pretty heated conversation there. The sons of God coming to present themselves before the Lord. Review, military review. This is the sons of God. This is taking place in heaven. Coming to present themselves before the Lord. Satan coming also to present himself before the Lord. God spoke first. Satan, sound off. Where you been? Give an account. I like to see God ordering Satan in this way, you know? Every once in a while we get the idea from someone else that he's sort of getting out from under God. But God calls him in and says, give an accounting of yourself. Now, Satan's pretty insolent about his response. He doesn't say, yes, sir, or aye, aye, sir. He says, I've been shooting to and fro throughout the earth and walking up and down. The Hebrew word, it's the word for lightning. Just, it never strikes twice in the same place. Seeking as a roaring lion whom he may devour. And Satan is telling us at this point from behind the scenes how he operates. Don't you think for a minute you can enter into direct person hand-to-hand combat with him and come out ahead. How long has he been in business, for one thing? Where did he begin? With man. He'd been sharpening his sword on men ever since the days of Adam and Eve. And he's had so much experience. We wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities and powers. He has the wisdom. A man's a fool if he thinks he can stand up against Satan in hand-to-hand combat. And Satan is telling us here about how he operates. He's shooting to and fro throughout the earth and walking up and down in it. And the Lord said to Satan, all right, Satan, you've been moving around pretty rapidly, but have you seen him? Huh?
It's God who calls Satan's attention to Job. It's not Satan who calls God's attention to Job. He says, you've been doing such a good job. What do you think about him? He's still a good man.
And Satan sort of sneers back and he says, yea, but thou hast built a hedge about him and about his house. Look how prosperous he is. And do you catch the significance of Satan's sneer? Job is pious because he's prosperous. But God, you pull the rug out from under him. You take away his prosperity. And he'll say, goodbye, God. The same word for curse God that had been used over there before. If God's going to do that to me, I don't have any time for him. Goodbye, God. And that's a pretty intelligent sneer, isn't it? Suppose God were to take away your possessions today. Would you be able to keep on believing in him, trusting in him? Or would you come to the point finally, what would it take to make you say that? All right, God, if you're going to do that to me, goodbye. This is what Job says. And God says, all right, Job, or all right, Satan, you try him out. Only listen, Satan. I'll let you go only so far and no farther. Only upon himself put not forth thine hand is the way he says it there. And you know what this reminds me of? Remember when Mark Twain, Sam Clemens down there told a story? Was it Huck Finn or Tom Sawyer? I keep forgetting which one it was. But the fellow came out and he wanted to fight that day. And he took his bare toe and he drew a line in the sand. And he says, all right, step across it. It seems to me this is the way God is sort of saying to Satan, all right, Satan, here's the line. You go that far and no farther. And here again, God controlling Satan. Talk with a young mother once whose baby daughter had been killed in an automobile accident by a drunken driver. And she said, did Satan do this in spite of God? And God spoke to her through this passage that God was permitting this. Satan didn't get out from under God and do something. He doesn't run wild. God keeps controlling it. And we'll see a little bit more of that a little later. But that's the end of scene two. It says that Satan, he didn't lose a minute there in verse 12. Satan went forth from the presence of the Lord. Now don't forget this, that Job doesn't know a thing of this conversation that you and I have heard between God and Satan. It's as though he's sitting here in the stage wall and Job is on this side and God and Satan are on this side and Job can't hear what's going on here, but you're sitting there and you can get both sides of it if you get what I mean. Job does not know, as he sits here alone, that God has called him a perfect and upright man. He knows of his relationship with God, yes, as well as any man knew it. He knows it. He does not hear God taunt Satan into coming down to test him. Now we begin in scene 3 in verse 13. There was a day when his sons and his daughters were eating and drinking wine in their eldest brother's house. And there came a messenger unto Job, and said, the oxen were plowing, and the asses feeding beside them, and the Sabaeans fell upon them, and took them away. Yea, they have slain the servant with the edge of the sword, and I only am escaped alone to tell it. While he was yet speaking, there came also another, and said, the fire of God is fallen from heaven, and hath burned up the sheep, and the servants, and consumed them, and I only am escaped alone to tell it. While he was yet speaking, there came also another, and said, the Chaldeans made out three bands, fell upon the camels, carried them away. Yea, and slain the servants with the edge of the sword, and I only am escaped alone to tell them. I hope you get the picture of this old Oriental monarch sitting out there underneath his palm tree with a long flowing white beard, and as far as he can see out across the horizon is his ranch. And beyond that horizon are the ranches of his children. And he's wealthy and prosperous in love as well as in possessions and wisdom. And he's happy to say, I don't know why he hadn't gone over to the family reunion that day. Maybe he was too old or something. He stayed behind to pray for the kids or what. But he hadn't gone. He's sitting there that day and all of a sudden he looks up and there comes that servant running over the horizon. And he knows that a servant doesn't run in the heat of the day unless there's something up. And the man says the Sabaeans fell upon the oxen and stole them. And I'm the only one that got away. And while he's yet speaking, he looks up and there comes another servant. It says, the fire of God, and it burned the sheep, and I'm the only one that got away. And the Chaldeans, they made out three bands and fell on the camels, and I'm the only one that got away. And Job
His old mathematical mind was clicking off these losses one right after the other. And you ask any man who's lived through the stock market depression, and from a man of tremendous wealth reduced to a position of terrible poverty within a period of a very few minutes. It happens yet today, you know. And Job only had one other possession. And I think his heart froze as he looked out across the horizon and saw one more servant coming to him. And while he was yet speaking, there came also another, and he said, "Thy sons and thy daughters were eating and drinking wine in the eldest brother's house. And behold, there came a great wind from the wilderness and smote the four corners of the house, and it fell upon the young men, and they are dead. And I only am escaped alone to tell thee." Then Job arose and rent his mantle and shaved his head and fell down upon the ground and worshipped and said, "Naked came I out of my mother's womb, and naked shall I return thither. The Lord gave, and the Lord hath taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." And in all this, Job sinned not, nor charged God foolishly. You see, man is great in his knowledge of misery. You do not find a dumb brute yapping with this kind of sorrow and misery. And Job is among the greatest specimens of human misery that the world has ever seen. As he rises and prostrates himself at the feet of his author, and he says in effect there, "If God hadn't given me so much in the first place, I couldn't have lost so much. Naked came I out of my mother's womb, and naked shall I return thither." But I think he said it through clenched teeth that day, "Blessed be the name of the Lord." Satan certainly didn't lose any time, but he didn't break Job. "Blessed be the name of the Lord." I don't know how much you could stand to lose before you'd keep on saying, "Blessed be the name of the Lord." But Job had lost his physical possessions. Satan had taken them. God had allowed it. Scene 4 begins in chapter 2 there. Do you see where it takes place? "Again there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord. Satan came also among them to present himself before the Lord. And the Lord said unto Satan, Whence comest thou?" Same scene exactly in heaven again. "From whence comest thou?" And Satan answered the Lord, the same thing that he said before, "From shooting to and fro on the earth and walking up and down in it." And the Lord said unto Satan, same words again, "Hast thou considered my servant Job, that there is none like him in the earth, a perfect and upright man, one that feareth God and escheweth evil, and still he holdeth fast his integrity, although thou movedest me, although thou movedest me against him to destroy him without a cause." You didn't get him, did you, Satan? He stands fast. You didn't get him, did you, Satan? Look at him again, Satan. He still holds fast. He's not pious just because he's prosperous. You pull the rug of prosperity out from under him and he still stands. What do you think of that, Satan? And Satan answered the Lord and said, "Skin for skin, all that a man hath will he give for his life. But put forth thine hand now and touch his bone in his flesh, and he will curse thee to thy face." The Lord said unto Satan, "Behold, he is in thine hand, but save his life." Now here again is Satan's sneer. He comes back and he says, "Yeah," he says, "but there's some men who are just so basically selfish that you can not only take every cent that they have, and even their families, but until they begin to hurt right at their nerve endings, they're just so basically selfish that you can take everything, even their families, away from them. But you make him hurt right down in his nerves, and then he'll say, goodbye, God." And God knew this was a loophole. Satan could have gotten out of it. He'd have done it. He'd have held that up before every generation. He said, men are pious. Men love God because God protects them. And so God says, all right, Satan. But here again, you better not kill him. You dare not kill him. Only save his life. And Satan would love to have killed him if he had dared. But he didn't. We'll see that a little bit later.
But he didn't. Now, scene 5 begins in verse 7 there in chapter 2. Satan didn't waste an instant of time. We won't be flashing back and forth from heaven to earth anymore. From verse 7 of the second chapter on through to the end of the 42nd chapter at the end of the book, we're down here on earth. And everything that happens from here on is on earth. Satan shot forth from the presence of the Lord and smote Job with sore boils, the sole of his foot unto his crown. He took him a potsherd to scrape himself withal and sat down among the ashes. The ash heap, to the Oriental of that day, was the place of quarantine. A man who had some kind of a disease for which there was no cure was isolated to the ash heap. He knew that he was going to die. And the word for boils is an unusual word. I've asked some Christian doctors to see if they could dig into this and find out what it was. And you might ask them too yourself, if they can get into the Hebrew sometime, to get the meaning out of it. The word there is he took a piece of pottery and he scraped the lid off one of those boils. But there's more to it, because it may have meant some kind of leprosy. It was a horrible disease of some kind, the most awful thing imaginable insofar as disease is concerned. He sat down among the ashes. Then, verse 9 and 10, and I want one of you ladies to tell me what kind of a woman Job's wife was. Then said Molly unto Job, Job, dost thou still retain thine integrity? Curse God and die. But he said unto her, Molly, thou speakest as one of the foolish women speak. What? Shall we receive good at the hand of God, and shall we not receive evil? And in all this did not Job sin with his lips. That's what we have. You tell me what kind of a woman she was. This is not a rhetorical question. I mean, give me your idea of what she was like.
I don't think she was bad. I think she wanted to tell God to take his life to keep him from suffering.
All right. Does anybody else have another idea? All right. You've been a little harder on her. She sounds evil. Okay. Now you said it. You see why I didn't ask any of the men? Well, no, this is a couple's conference, and this is why. This is a family book. You see what I mean? God's speaking to families here. No, I think she was a remarkable woman. One of the things that makes me know that is verse 9 down here is her speech. Now, there are 42 chapters in the whole book. And this is the only time she says anything. I think she's a remarkable woman. I agree with you. But she does encourage Job to say the very thing that Satan had said he would say. She encourages Job at this particular minute to say, oh, just turn to God and say, well, goodbye, God. Now, that's her point of advice to him at this point. But you see, I think somebody said it here, they were really getting at this. I don't think that she was a gold digger. She stuck with her husband. He was isolated. He'd lost all his possessions. She stuck with him. She stayed with him out there on the ash heap. Beyond this, I think she loved him, maybe a little too much. She just couldn't stand to see him suffer. And you see, her faith rested on two pillars. One was her husband's integrity, and the other was God's faithfulness. And she lived with her husband, and she knew that he hadn't done anything that could cause this kind of suffering. And the only thing left to doubt was God's faithfulness. And so she did. She said, Job, why don't you just doubt God? And he says, well, Molly, I don't understand you today. You're not like yourself. You're talking as one of the foolish women today. This is not like you. And she forgot, because she loved her husband a little too much, I think, at that point. She forgot that if he had said farewell to God and then had died, he'd have gone before the judgment seat of the very God he'd said farewell to. And if he'd said farewell to God and then had not died, he'd have been just that much more miserable. You see, it had been Satan's dilemma. When he had removed the children, he could also have removed the wife. And perhaps this would have been the straw that broke the camel's back. But to leave her there, to bring her influence to bear when his defenses were weakened all the more. And I think that it was a tremendous influence. Here they sit for years and years, and Job had learned to trust Molly, and every time a camel driver came past, and Job had gone out and he said, "I'm going to buy that camel, Molly," and she hadn't paid a bit of attention to the camel. She'd been looking at the driver the whole time. She said, "Job, don't do it." He says, "I'm going to do it anyway." And so he did it. And the next morning, the camel turned out to be swayed back to whatever. I guess you wouldn't have that. But anyhow, the point was that he had learned to trust her all through the years in their business dealings. And now, when she counseled him in distraction, simply because she loved him so much, she couldn't stand to see him suffer. It was a tremendous temptation to him to go along with her. And Job didn't do it. He said, "Molly, you're not like yourself today. I don't understand you." And if there's one thing, I'm sure that she was a good woman because she lived with him. No godly man ever lived with an ungodly woman and was completely happy with her in the way that we find Job and his wife apparently being happy on through this book. Knowing that that godless woman would not be with him in heaven throughout eternity. No godly man ever lived with an ungodly woman and was so completely happy as Job was here. The opposite's true too. And it seems to me one of the things God is saying to us as families at this point is that I put you down here in terms of a husband and wife relationship. And there will come the time in that fortuitous concourse of events when one of the two will say, "Oh, let's quit trying." And then the other one, and sometimes it's a husband and sometimes it's a wife, but the other one's going to have to come back around and say, "What? Are we going to accept good at the hand of God down through all these years and then not accept this little bit of evil?" No. We sharpen each other. We cause each other to grow in the Christian life. That wasn't the end of the trials, though. In verse 11, we go back, and this time Satan attacks in a different way. He's trying to wear this old man down. "Now when Job's three friends heard of all this evil that was come upon him, they came every one from his own place, Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, Zophar the Naamathite. For they had made an appointment together to come to mourn with him and to comfort him. And when they lifted up their eyes afar off and knew him not, they lifted up their voice and wept." Apparently he was so far gone, disfigured with this disease, they couldn't even recognize him. "And they lifted up their voice and wept, rent everyone his mantle, sprinkled dust on their heads toward heaven, sat down upon the ground 7 days and seven nights, and none spake a word unto him, for they saw that his grief was very great." 7 days and seven nights under these conditions were this was the beginning of what used to be called the wake. They did this for a person who was dead, a funeral. And it meant that they considered Job to be as good as dead. Now these three men weren't just happened to be out riding. They were good old buddies of Job. And they decided to come, and notice why they had made an appointment to come together to mourn with him and to comfort him. Their objective stated, and their primary reason for riding across the desert on his camel, was to come to comfort him, to be with him and to help him in every way. Now we'll see what happens. After this, Job opened his mouth and cursed his day. Job spake and he said, "Let the day perish wherein I was born, and the night in which it was said, there's a man-child conceived. Let that day be darkness. Let not God regard it from above, neither let the light shine upon it." And he goes on in that same vein down to what Job is saying is, I just wish I could reach up there and tear February the 7th right out of the calendar. If there had never been that day, I couldn't have been born. And we talk about Job, you see, being the most patient man that ever lived. Now, that's a burst of impatience. Endurance. Not patience. Patience is the wrong word there. And that's not the first time we'll see that in Job either. He goes on like that for one whole chapter. And then in chapter 4, Eliphaz the Temanite answered and said, we know that Eliphaz was the oldest man, in spite of the way the play is written, and other things like that. We know that Eliphaz was the oldest man because he speaks first. The Oriental custom was that the oldest man spoke first. And Eliphaz answered and said, if we essay to commune with thee, wilt thou be grieved? But who can withhold himself from speaking? Behold, Job, thou hast instructed many in years gone by, and thou hast strengthened the weak hands in years gone by. Thy words have upheld in him that was fallen in years gone by, and thou hast strengthened the feeble knees in other years. But now, Job, it is come upon thee, and thou faintest. It toucheth thee, and thou art troubled. Is not this thy fear, thy confidence, thy hope, the uprightness of thy ways? Remember, Job, whoever perished being innocent, or where were the righteous cut off? Even as I have seen. Now there's the old man who strokes his beard and thinks back in life. This is a typical phrase from an old man. Even as I have seen, they that plow iniquity and sow wickedness reap the same. Now, all the first part of that is complimentary, isn't it? He tells Job about all the wonderful things he's done for all these people in years gone by. And then he comes right down there in verse 7. He said, remember, whoever perished being innocent. The righteous were never cut off. Those that plow iniquity and sow wickedness reap the same. That's a quick kind of comfort, isn't it? Job, you're just getting what you deserve. You're suffering, it means you must have sinned. The cause of this suffering is sin. Eliphaz jumps at that conclusion. He can't think of anything else. A man's suffering, he must have sinned. If he sins, he's going to suffer. And these two ideas were so fused in his thinking that over and over and over again, in one way or another, this is the whole gist of Eliphaz's speech. And if you want to carry through and evaluate it yourself, you'll find that down through there. For two whole chapters, chapters 4 and chapter 5, and he's insisting over and over and over again that Job's suffering had been caused by sin. No man ever suffered unless he'd sinned. No man ever sinned unless he suffered. This is what he's saying. Chapter 6, Job answered him. Job answered and he said, oh, that my grief were thoroughly weighed and my calamity laid in the balances forever. For now it would be heavier than the sand of the sea. Therefore my words are swallowed up. The arrows of the Almighty are within me. The poison whereof drinketh up my spirit, the terrors of God do set themselves in array against me. But let me ask you something, Eliphaz. Doth the wild ass bray when he hath grass? Or loweth the ox over his fodder? Eliphaz, do you think for a minute that I'd be sitting here trying to figure out what caused this if I knew that I had done sin, the kind of sin that could deserve this kind of suffering? A wild ass doesn't even bray if he has something to eat. You hear me braying. I'm complaining. So you know that there must be something to cause this. If I knew of sin, I wouldn't be complaining this way. Of course, you and I know that he hadn't done any sin that could cause this. You and I saw on the other side there the part that he couldn't see. And we saw God challenging Satan to pull the rug out from under this poor old man. Now Satan is trying to get Job to admit that he's done sin. And that would have been sin enough if he'd admitted it. Because he hasn't. Well, Job denies it. He spends two whole chapters there, chapter 6 and chapter 7, denying it. Then we go over to chapter 8 and Bildad, the other friend, made an appointment to come together to comfort him. Then answered Bildad the Shuhite, and he said to Job, how long wilt thou speak these things, and how long shall the words of thy mouth be like a strong wind? Job, you're full of hot air. Doth God pervert judgment, or doth the Almighty pervert justice? If thy children have sinned against him, and he have cast them away for their transgression. And oh, how that would have hurt that old man at that point. Bereaved so recently? If thou wouldst seek unto God betimes, if thou wouldst make thy supplication unto the Almighty, if thou wert pure and upright, surely now he would awake for thee and make the habitation of thy righteousness prosperous. Though thy beginning was small, yet thy latter end should greatly increase. And then he goes ahead. Now the thing that recommends Bildad more than anything else, he's a historian, and he refers to history and to all the instances of this that they've seen in history. And he endorses heartily this old idea that if we could just study history and get the formula out of history and then fit the facts of the current events into that formula, we could predict the future and know exactly what the cause and problem was and what the future was going to be. And he's just full of this. And this is what he... And over again, he comes over this. Job, you've sinned. Therefore, you're suffering. You're suffering because you sinned. He says it back and forth, over and over again. It's the same argument. Same one that Eliphaz had. And he goes through two whole chapters. Just one chapter, chapter 8. Chapter 9, then Job answered. He answered Bildad. He says, I know it is so of a truth, but how should man be just with God? If man will contend with God, he cannot answer him one of a thousand. He is wise in heart and mighty in strength, who hath hardened himself against him and prospered. And Job goes still on down through there again to deny that he has done the kind of sin that could cause this kind of suffering. Of course, you and I know the source of this suffering. We know that it's not sin, but Job doesn't. Job goes through chapters 9, chapter 10. He knows it's not sin, but he doesn't know what does cause it. Chapter 11, we come to Zophar. And Zophar is the youngest of the three men, and he's sort of an upstart. And here's this gray-haired old Oriental monarch sitting there, and he has all this suffering to go on. His young upstart comes prancing in, and he has a bright new shiny PhD or RFD right out of the mail order catalog, and he's just going to show everybody. He just comes because he can think. And he's going to show them exactly what he can think. Then answered Zophar the Naamathite, and he said, should not the multitude of words be answered, and should a man full of talk be justified? Should thy lies make men hold their peace? And when thou mockest, shall no man make thee ashamed? For thou hast said, my doctrine is pure, and I am clean in thine eyes. But oh, that God would speak and open his lips against thee, and that he would show thee the secrets of wisdom, that they are double to that which is. Know therefore that God exacteth of thee less than thine iniquity deserved. Queer comfort. God exacteth of thee less than thine iniquity deserved. And then Zophar goes on down through there to speak for God. He pretends to know the secrets of God and the mysteries of God. And he opens, unfolds these one by one to Job. And the gist of his whole speech is that same thing again. Job, you sinned. You're suffering. You must have sinned. There's no other way out of it. He's just as confident as he can be. No possible doubt. And Job, patience? Look in chapter 12 there how he answered it. And Job answered and he said, no doubt but ye are the people and wisdom shall die with you. But I have understanding as well as you. I am not inferior to you. Yea, who knoweth not such things as these? I am as one mocked of his neighbor, who calleth upon God and he answereth him, and the just upright man is laughed to scorn. Yeah, and patience? Endurance. This poor old man, you can't help it. He strikes fire with it. And he comes right back shooting, and I think we can fairly see the fire come out of his eyes when he starts speaking back there. He goes on for two chapters then, and then Eliphaz takes up the cudgel again, and Job answers him, and Bildad takes up the cudgel again, and Job answers him. But it's in the 19th chapter that we come to the high point in the entire book, the 19th chapter. I don't know. Well, we do know how many times they've spoken. Chapter 19, verse 1 there, Job answered and he said, how long will you vex my soul and break me in pieces with words? These 10 times have you reproached me, and you're not ashamed that you make yourself strange to me. Be it indeed that I have erred, mine error remaineth with myself. If indeed ye will magnify yourselves against me and plead against me my reproach, then know now that God hath overthrown me. God hath compassed me with his net. Job knows. He knows. But he's miserable about it. Look over in verse 14. He says, my kinsfolk have failed. My familiar friends have gotten me. I don't know what your sufferings have been, but I know you haven't hit any more of a bottom than Job did down through here. They that dwell in mine house, verse 15, and my maids count me for a stranger. I'm an alien in thy sight. I called my servant and he gave me no answer. I entreated him with my mouth. My breath is strange to my wife, though I entreated for the children's sake of mine own body. Yea, young children despised me, and I arose, and they spake against me. All my inward friends abhorred me. They whom I loved are turned against me, and my bone cleaveth to my skin and to my flesh, and I am escaped with the skin of my teeth.
Have pity upon me, oh, have pity upon me, ye my friends, for the hand of God hath touched me. Why do ye persecute me as God, and are not satisfied with my flesh? And then something happens to him, and he comes back again there in verse 23 and 24 and 25, and he says, oh, that my words, the thing I'm going to say next, that these were written, that they were printed in a book. No more than that. Oh, that these were graven with an iron pen and led into the rock forever. This was the way they had, you know, of fixing something so you'd never forget it. They chiseled the words out in the rock, and then they poured lead in there. You see this idea in some gravestones today, so that even if the stone is worn away, the lead remains. And Job said, the thing I'm going to say next, I don't want anybody in the world ever, ever, ever to forget. I want the whole world to know this. For I know that my Redeemer liveth, and that he shall stand at the latter day upon the earth. And though after my skin worms destroy this body, yet in my flesh shall I see God. And those are his words. All that Satan had been able to do to him in bringing this pressure to bear. I know that my Redeemer liveth. It's a very, very, very interesting word that Job used for Redeemer. It's the word Goel. It's the same word that Naomi used when she was referring to Boaz, my kinsman, my blood relative. It's like the little girl, a little bit. She got lost. And she says, well, if you just find my mummy, she'll make everything all right. And Job says, I have a kinsman, a blood relative. And he's going to make things right. And then the other meaning of that word is a vindicator. A redeemer. The word goel is very often translated vindicator. The one who vindicates or makes right the suffering. The wrong suffering. He makes it right. And then the word that we have translated here in the King James, of course, redeemer. The one who's going to buy back anything that has been lost. Job used that very, very precious word there when he says, I know that my Redeemer, my kinsman, vindicator, buyer back, I know that he liveth and that he shall stand at the latter day upon the earth. And it's remarkable to me the way those words have sung themselves into the hearts of people every Christmas time we find them. I know that my Redeemer liveth. People haven't forgotten that. And that's the high point. Satan had done everything that he possibly could. And this is the response that Job comes back with. Miserable, dropped down to the very bottom. Satan's forbidden to take his life. But he's done everything else imaginable to bring pressure to bear upon this poor old man, to tell him to forget God, to say goodbye to God. And he comes up with this. I know that my Redeemer liveth. Now that doesn't mean that Satan quit, because in the chapters that follow, Zophar picks up the cudgel and Job answers, and Eliphaz and Job answers, and Bildad and Job answers, and it goes clear on over there till a man by the name of Elihu enters the picture and Job answers him too. But Elihu's a little bit better than the others, not much better. It's the same general idea though. Elihu's idea is about the same as the other three men. But then, clear on over in verse 38, in chapter 38, something happened. Then, finally, the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind. And he said, who is this that darkeneth counsel by words without knowledge? And he's referring to the men before. That's a powerful sentence there. Words without knowledge. You hear a lot of words without knowledge today. And God said, who is this? Now, Job, you asked before, and Job several times back here had said, oh, if only I could reason with God. And the Hebrew word that he uses there means to present my brief, as a lawyer does in court. If only I could present my case to God himself. And so God takes him up and almost quotes from him. He says, Job, gird up now thy loins like a man, for I will demand of thee and answer thou me. Job, I'm going to explain to you about the things that have happened to you, about why it was necessary for you to suffer. But before I can get into the moral aspects of this, I'm going to have to find out what your IQ is.
I'm going to have to find out how well you can think and what you do understand. And so to begin with, we're going to ask you some physical questions about the physical world. To begin with, Job, where wast thou when I laid the foundations of the earth? Job, did you have a pre-existence? Do you know anything about where you were when the world was created? Who hath laid the measures of the earth, if thou knowest? Or who hath stretched the line upon it, whereon are all the foundations fastened? Or who laid the cornerstone thereof? Job, do you know how it was that we decided the tilt of the axis of the earth should be at such and such a degree, so that it wouldn't be too hot or too cold? You know, this is the problem we're still wrestling with a little bit, isn't it? How is it that the earth happened to be tilted at just this degree toward the sun? If it's a little more, our scientists tell us we'd burn up or else we'd freeze. Job, do you know about how we decided that the day we did? That was the day the morning stars sang for joy, verse 7, and all the sons of God shouted for joy. And this sea thing, Job, do you know who shut up the sea with doors when it break forth as if it had issued out of the womb? That's the day I made the cloud the garment thereof, and the thick darkness a swaddling band for it, and break it up for it my decreed place, and set my bars and doors, and said, hitherto shalt thou come and no further. He's asking him all kinds of questions about the sea down through there. Of course, we're still finding out. In verse 16, hast thou entered into the springs of the sea, or walked in the search of the depth? What was it? Just this year they found that salt sea over there in one of the... was it the Red Sea? It was one of the landlocked seas of the continent, Europe, Asia, over there where they found the heat and the salt concentration. It was in the current events column of U.S. News and World Report just the other day. We're still finding out about these things. And God asked Job, and Job doesn't answer anything through here at this point. And he goes on down through there. In verse 22, Job, hast thou entered into the treasures of the snow, or hast thou seen the treasures of the hail? Oh, yes, we have. Sure, we have a microscope. But this was the oldest book in the Bible. How did the writer of this book know to put that in there, the treasures of the snow? Sure, we've seen those geometrical patterns in the snow. And we've split open a hailstone. But this is in the middle of a desert, as far as we can find out. How'd Job know about these things, or the writer of this book? Job, if you didn't know about them, do you know how we made them in the first place? How we formed them? And we're still studying those things. He goes on down through there in verse 31. Job, canst thou bind the sweet influences of Pleiades, or loose the bands of Orion? Pleiades and Orion, these are constellations. What holds these constellations in place? I have a friend down here at Boulder who's doing, as his doctorate in astrophysics, he's doing work for NASA. And he tells me that they're studying now, and this is one of his projects. And some of these satellites that go out into space have instruments that are bringing back data for his computations about the recreation of new stars. This idea that new stars are being made continually. And God's asking Job about these things. I have taken these next chapters from time to time and given them to scientists. And in their various fields, they tell me that the questions that God was asking Job are the questions that are being researched in government grants and other such things in our great laboratories today. That we're still trying to find the answers to God's questions to Job. And you may want to go on through and read these things. Dr. Davis up at Purdue was lecturing out of this to the scientists out in New Mexico at a conference or some kind of a meeting that they were having, men from all over the United States, and he lectured to them out of this. And it's one question after another that God is asking Job. And finally in verse 42, then Job answered the Lord and he said, I know that thou canst do everything. Chapter 42. Job says, Lord, I know you can do everything and that no thought can be withholden from thee. Job says in verse 6, wherefore I abhor myself and repent in dust and ashes. Now the word abhor there does not have the moral connotations of a confession of sin. It has limitations, the idea of intellectual limitations. God, I just can't answer. I don't know. I don't have the intelligence necessary to answer your questions, God. And God, in effect, says, well, Job, I can't explain to you all the reasons why it is necessary for you to suffer not having sinned. Of course, you and I know a lot more about this because we've seen both sides of the ledger. We know now why it was that God called Satan's attention to Job. This old man stood firm through all that testing, and he proved to the world that a man who suffers has not necessarily sinned. Of course, it's easy for us because we've seen Jesus Christ suffering, having never sinned. The Redeemer, the Kinsman, the Goel that Job was talking. We've seen him on the cross. Job hadn't. Then how much easier should it be for you and for me to suffer, having seen Jesus Christ, than for Job, having never seen him? But Job knew him. I know that my Redeemer liveth. And God went on there in verse 7. It was so that after the Lord had spoken these words unto Job, the Lord said to Eliphaz the Temanite, Eliphaz, my wrath is kindled against thee and against thy two friends, for ye have not spoken of me the thing that is right, as my servant Job hath. You kept saying that he was suffering because he'd sinned. You have not spoken of me the thing that is right, as my servant Job hath. Therefore, take unto you now 7 bullocks and 7 rams, and go to my servant Job, and offer up sacrifices, a burnt offering. And if my servant Job shall pray for you, him will I accept, lest I deal with you after your folly, in that ye have not spoken of me the thing which is right, like my servant Job. So Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, Zophar the Naamathite went and did according to the Lord commanded them. The Lord also accepted Job. Here again is a man who opens his home and prays for other people in it. And the Lord turned the captivity of Job when he prayed for his friends. Also the Lord gave Job twice as much as he had before. Twice as much. Then came there unto him all his brethren and all his sisters and all that had been of his acquaintance before and did eat bread with him at his house. They bemoaned him and comforted him over all the evil the Lord had brought upon him. Every man gave him a piece of money and an earring of gold. Man's on his way up. Everybody wants to help him. Man's on his way down. They don't care a thing. That's true to life, isn't it? So the Lord blessed the latter end of Job more than his beginning. He had 14,000 sheep. In verse 10, it says the Lord gave Job twice as much as he had before. In verse 12, it says he had given him 14,000 sheep. How many sheep did he have in the first chapter? In the last chapter, he had 6,000 camels. How many camels did he have in the first chapter? In the last chapter, he had 1,000 yoke of oxen. How many did he have in the first chapter? In the last chapter, he had 1,000 she-asses. How many did he have in the first chapter? In the last chapter, how many sons and daughters does he have? How many sons and daughters did he have in the first chapter? What happened? Bible make a mistake? Not trustworthy. You can find all kinds of commentaries pointing their finger at that and saying, that's just one of the inconsistencies in the Bible. God promised that he'd double it, but the Bible made a mistake here. Very bad error. Was God unfaithful? He promised he would, but he didn't. Should have given him 14 sons and 6 daughters, you see. But he didn't. He made a mistake. Is that right? Yeah?
He had 14 sons.
Right. Right. Job had 14 sons and 6 daughters, and 7 of those sons and 3 of those daughters were just as much alive as they had ever been. They were in heaven. He had to double the animals because they were on earth. But this is a quiet little reference to the immortality of the soul. It was another existence for the souls of the people. Job had 14 sons and 6 daughters. And those of you who've lost children, you can expect to look forward to them, to see them there. We look forward to seeing the little girl that we never knew. And there are many of the rest of you who look forward to meeting those loved ones there. And what they'll be like. 14 sons and 6 daughters. The Bible doesn't make any mistake. God doesn't prove himself unfaithful. Job went on in verse 14, he called the name of the first Jemima, and the name of the second Keziah, and the name of the third Karen Hapuk, and in all the land were no women found so fair as the daughters of Job. You wouldn't expect to find that kind of a sentence in the Bible. They were nice looking girls. But it's there. In all the land were no women found so fair as the daughters of Job, and their father gave them inheritance among their brethren. After this lived Job 140 years, and he saw his sons and his sons' sons, even 4 generations. So Job died, being old and full of days. Very interesting Hebrew form. That is, his cup of days of time was just filled. It didn't overflow. It was just filled perfectly with life. Family life. God communicates himself to the world through the family. And he'll speak to your neighbors through your experiences with him. And they're watching your life in prosperity and in trial. And there may very well come that time before you get home or after you're there when you too are going to have to look back and say, but I know that my Redeemer liveth.